ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 11 चैप्टर 3 टेक्स्ट नंबर 13 Srimad Bhagavatam gives several descriptions of the material creation by which the air is expanded from ether, fire from air, water from fire, and earth from water. Now in the reverse order, the creation is wound up. Thus earth merges back into water from which it came, and water similarly merges into fire. Text 14. Hrittarupam tu tamasara yojati padite Hrittispasya vakasena vayodana basi dhiyate Alatmana hritakunam nava atmani dhiyate Fire deprived of its form by darkness dissolves into the element air. When the air loses its quality of touch by the influence of space, the air merges into that space. When space is deprived of its tangible quality by the supreme soul in the form of time, space merges into false ego in the mode of ignorance. Indriyani vano buddhira sahava karikara nipa ravi shanti yaham karam sagana aham atmani. My dear king, the material senses and intelligence merge into false ego in the mode of passion from which they arose, and the mind, along with the demigods, merges into false ego in the mode of goodness. Then the total false ego, along with all of its qualities, merges into the Mahatattva. Text 16. Ishamaya Bhagavata Sagasityantakarini Trivana Vanitasnavi Akimbuya Sotam Ichchasi. I have now described Maya, the illusory energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This illusory potency, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is empowered by the Lord for the creation, maintenance, and annihilation of the material universe. Now what more do you wish to hear? Purport. King Nimi had expressed to the Navayugendras his fear of the illusory potency of the Lord and had requested a detailed explanation of Maya so that he could avoid becoming a victim at her hands. Now Sri Antariksha, having described the illusory potency, is suggesting that the king inquire about the means to become totally free of Maya's influence. Now, waiting for the king to ask such a question, Sri Antariksha himself is suggesting, now that you have heard about Maya's influence, you should inquire about the process of becoming free of such influence. According to Sridhar Swami, that is the significance of Sri Antariksha's question, Kim Bhuya Shrutam Ishtasi? What more do you wish to hear? The following is a summary of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakura's explanation of the process of annihilation described in the previous verses. Bhaktadeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the presiding deity of consciousness, which becomes manifest within the Mahatattva. By further transformations of the Mahatattva, the threefold false ego appears as follows. From Vaikarikana, false ego in the mode of goodness, appears the 11th sense, the mind, whose presiding deity is Aniruddha. From Tejasa, false ego in the mode of passion, comes intelligence, whose presiding deity is Prajumna, and the five working senses and five knowledge acquiring senses with their various presiding deities. From false ego in the mode of ignorance arises the subtle form of sound, and from that sound or sabda all the material elements gradually become manifest, beginning with ether and the sense of hearing. The presiding deity of these three divisions of false ego is Sankarsan. This description is taken from chapter 26 of the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, verses 21, 27, 28, 30, 31, 32, and 35. The Supreme Personality of Godhead's external potency, Maya, causes the birth, maintenance and destruction of the material world. She is three colours, red, white and black. In her red feature, the material nature is created, in white it endures, and in black it is annihilated. The Mahatattva arises from this Maya, and from that Mahatattva come the three varieties of false ego mentioned above. At the time of annihilation, the five great elements, namely earth, water, fire, air, and ether, merge into the false ego in the mode of ignorance from which they are originally generated. The ten senses and intelligence merge into the false ego in passion, and the mind, along with the demigods, merges into false ego in the mode of goodness, which then merges into Mahatattva, which further takes shelter of the Prakriti or unmanifest Vedanta. As described above, each of the gross elements is wound up when its distinguishing quality is removed. The element then merges into the previous element. This can be understood as follows. In space or ether, there is the quality of sound. In air, there are the qualities of sound and touch. In fire, there are sound, touch and form. In water, there is sound, touch, form and taste. And in earth, there are sound, touch, form, taste and aroma. Therefore, from ether down to earth, each element is distinguished by the addition of its own unique quality called guna-visesham. When that quality is removed, an element becomes non-different from its previous element and thus merges into it. For example, when great winds take aroma from the earth, earth contains only sound, touch, form and taste, and thus becomes non-different from water into which it merges. Similarly, when water loses its rasa or taste, it contains only sound, touch and form, thus becoming non-different from fire, which also contains those three qualities. So the wind takes away aroma to merge earth into water and takes away taste to merge water into fire. Then when the universal darkness removes form from fire, fire merges into air. Space then removes the sense of touch from air, and air merges into space. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, as a time element, removes sound from space, and space then merges into the false ego and the mode of ignorance from which it arose. Finally, false ego is merged into the Mahatattva, which is merged into the unmanifested Pradhan, and thus the universe is annihilated. So this is a very detailed description here of the process of annihilation. Maharaj Nimi has been informed by Antariksha in the Navi Yogendras about the very nature of the illusory material energy. So, of course, this the time frame for this total devastation, to calculate that, or one day of Brahma, is 4,320,000,000 years. Is one day. 4,320,000,000 years. 430 trillion years. So therefore Brahma's one day and one night is 8,860,000,000 years. It's one day and one night. Now, for 1 month we would multiply that by 30, and then to get 1 year we multiply that by 12, and then to get the lifetime of Brahma, 100 years, we multiply that by 100. That is the duration of the universe. That is the time frame for this creation and then annihilation. Seems like a long time. That's it's interesting that this scenario, the creation and the destruction of the universe, is given in order for us to understand the temporary nature of the material manifestation. And yet, when you talk in terms of so many, you know, hundreds of trillions of years, you would, you know, it's hard to imagine in one sense how someone would think, oh, you know, I'm only going to be in this material world for hundreds and trillions of years. So, for the average person, they probably could not get the significance of, you know, like for instance, if you said to them, you know, you're going to build a house. You know, if you say you go to university for so many years, you work, you know, in your career for so many years, you build a house, it'll take you so many years. Once you've constructed that house, you may get to live there for 20 odd years and then, you know, perhaps, you know, death may come and they've asked for a lifetime. So that, you know, that may help them understand the temporary nature. So this is similar in that we're talking about, you know, hundreds of trillions of years, but still it's temporary. In what way would this understanding help a conditioned soul to you know, understand the illusory nature of the material world, its temporary nature, how it's created and destroyed, and yet over trillions and trillions of years, how does this help the conditioned soul?
Try to be comfortable. Miserable.
Do you think they try to get out? You know, the average person. See, for a lot of people, if they're, you know, even in this one lifetime, if they think, oh, you know, if they're 60 years old, they might think I'm going to live for another 10 years. A lot of people that think that may be a long time. So then, you know, if you say you've got another 10 years to live, they generally think, oh, I've got so much time, I won't really panic or change anything, or I'll just keep going with what I'm doing. What they speak is they think that they have many lifetimes, so hundreds of trillions of years, why would they panic and want to, you know, get out of the material world? How, in what way would this information somehow influence, you know, the spiritual and material existence that, you know, one achieves liberation? That's a good point. That's a very good That's a good point. If they actually understand that that's suffering for hundreds of trillions of years, that's a fact, then that would help them. Yes. Any other?
For a normal beginner, it's inconceivable. They can't even imagine when we talk of trillions and billions of years.
That's what I'm saying. It's inconceivable to them, so therefore, given this information, how does a person take advantage of it in some way that it, you know, influences them to want to get out of material existence? That's my point. Considering it's such a long time, you know, hundreds of trillions of years.
Just accept that it's too long time to go back to spiritual world.
Well, that's another good point, that considering that they understand the spirit soul. And as Nanda was pointing out, that they realise that they're going to be happy in spiritual existence and not in material existence. Therefore thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to suffer and not actually enjoy the spiritual existence for hundreds of trillions of years, then that's a very terrible situation as a fact. So in one sense, it sort of it hinges upon the understanding that it's a suffering condition, that it's not a place of enjoyment. Right? So in both. So if one thinks that they're actually enjoying the material world, then hundreds of trillions and trillions of, you know, of years, in one sense, seems like a good thing. And they think, well, you know, enjoy for hundreds and hundreds of trillions of years, and then even when the universe is wound up, you know, will be merged in the body of Mahavishnu again for, you know, hundreds and hundreds and trillions of years, and then we'll come out in another universe and enjoy. But yeah, it's a fact that, you know, hinging on that realization that this world is a place of suffering, especially if, you know, all the different types of 8,400,000 different species of life that one can take within that, you know, trillion of years, one can, you know, then it's a horrible thought. Yeah. Then it becomes a horrible thought. Of course, here, Another you know, significant point, of course, is that it's sort of like some sort of mechanical arrangement, temporary arrangement for happiness, which is an artificial situation. Just like you know, if you set up a theatre to do a play, so you set up the theatre. So there's you know, a breakdown of everything at the end of each night. So imagine you're in the play, and it's Romeo and Juliet. So you know, every day you go to work, you're in the play. There's, you know, Juliet, and you're Romeo, and you know, and then everything breaks down at the end of the day. You know, it's all finished. The Romeo and Juliet is finished, and so this goes on day after day. You know, you go, it breaks down. And then, of course, after some time, the whole show is over, and even after some time, the whole picture theatre, you know, the whole building is demolished, everything is finished, like that. So, a normal person wouldn't take that relationship as very significant, you know, because they know that that sort of relationship is, you know, you can't have a proper relationship if you go, you know, you set up sort of an artificial relationship that lasts for about 1 or 2 hours during the play, and then it's all finished. And then you come back and you know, start again the next day like that, and it's all finished. And after some time, the play is over. And one says material existence is like that. You know, one lifetime, you come along, you put on the costume, you know, a particular type of body, you get all set up, you get relationships, you know, like that. And then at the end, it's all dismantled. And then a new play, like that. So it's sort of, you know, it's like that. You can't, you know, people have this, because materialistic people have this false notion that, you know, when they fall in love, I will love you forever. You know, whenever I hear that, you know, how can I use that word, forever? And people do that, you know, forever. But, you know, there's no forever in material existence. But they, you know, they somehow have this forever. There's some, you know, there's, even after death, somehow, you know, they'll be connected in that relationship. Because they want it to be, they just, you know, people will imagine that somehow or another, you know, I will fight up death, I will fight up, you know, everything. Somehow we will be connected in love forever. And yes, people believe in that. But actually, you know, in the next life, in this life, there's a relationship with the man and the woman. In the next life, you know, relationship to two grasshoppers. You know? And then the grasshopper is looking at the other grasshopper. Ah, yes, I will love you forever. actually, I was reading somewhere in the books, I think it was, maybe a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita by Vishwanath Chakravarti or something like that, but I was describing how, you know, ants, you know, they actually attracted, you know, there's an attraction to each other like that, you know, one ant is looking at another, oh, you are so beautiful. So, you know, the love does go on, but in different bodies. Tasmanian, one life, the Tasmanian devil, you know, the Tasmanian devil, the little creatures that they make this strange, squealing, devilish sound. They sound like a child being murdered. You know, they call them the Tasmanian devil because the sound they make is horrific, you know, screeching, screaming type of a sound. They're very ferocious, raised sharp teeth. They're like a sort of cross between a dog and a rat. They're not very nice looking. But they're in danger. But so, you know, one Tasman main he devil, one Tasman she devil, they're very attractive to each other. And you see within all different species of life. Actually, one time I was walking with my spiritual master in New Zealand, and we'd just done a program, and then we went for a walk, a jumper walk through a park, and in this park they had all different birds and sort of aviaries. And we stopped and we were looking in. I was standing with my spiritual master, and there were two birds, and one bird was sort of just resting her head on the male bird, and you could see that they were, you know, obviously, you know, very close, very affectionate to each other, a couple. And my spiritual master turned around to me and he quoted this verse from the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, explaining how, you know, these principles of, you know, the sense gratificating, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, but, you know, the mating and the love and the relationships and the family, that goes on in every species of life. So people have a, you know, this strange misconception, oh yes, our love will endure for all time and you know, what have you. But basically, in one sense, the love does that misplaced sense of love or affection, but it doesn't always hit the person, the target they're hoping to. In the next life, when they find that, you know, when Romeo finds that Juliet is no longer there and he's in the body of the Tasmanian devil, he will forget Juliet very quickly, and the she-devil will become his new Juliet, without a doubt. In fact, in the body of the Tasmanian devil, he would not be attracted to a human. He would actually be forced by that body. You know, by that body, he would actually attract it only to, you know, the Tasmanian devils. You see that. You know, crows are attracted to crows, and swans are attracted to other swans. They're all birds. You don't see, you know, crows chasing after beautiful men and women. Come and live in my nest with me. You know, each species has a certain, you know, they have an attraction for the opposite sex in that species. So, when you think, you know, over trillions and trillions of years, how many different material bodies that one will take, then it becomes very fearful. As soon as we understand that even in this human form of life, there is certainly a lot of suffering, a lot of work for a little bit of enjoyment, I think, you know, it'd be interesting if, you know, throughout the course of life, if people actually calculated, you know, they had a journal and they wrote down the times they actually think they're enjoying and the times they actually spent trying to get those few minutes of enjoyment. So, you know, if you sort of wrote a list, you know, calculate at the end of life, so say you live for, you know, 75 years, and you work out that, you know, out of those 75 years, there's probably about 3 hours of what we call actual enjoyment. The rest of the time, I studied, worked, you know, fought off illnesses, fought off enemies, you know, battled to pay the bills, struggled for existence, you know, struggled for other existence, struggled with the mind, struggled with so many, you know, to ward off so many different types of suffering. And yes, so there was so much struggle for existence, and out of that I managed to get 3 or 4 really good hours of enjoyment. So, when we think that, then that's human form of life, and then we think, oh, you know, if we take birth as a, you know, a cricket or a, you know, a cockroach or, you know, a spider running out of someone's house and being chased by someone slipping, you know, how much enjoyment, you know, do we really have? over trillions and trillions of years. So this is the illusory energy. And after all, of course, the other point is that it is just a temporary illusory existence. It's not the reality. Of course, part of what we hear in Srimad Bhagavatam here is that the material world, the illusory material world, is put together by the illusory energy. It's set up for some limited amount of time. Everything is mechanically set in place, but a little bit of enjoyment and a lot of struggle. But the Srimad Bhagavatam also describes the spiritual energy and the spiritual world in comparison. So that's a very important, as we go through the Srimad Bhagavatam, and of course in previous chapters it's already been spoken of, that we can understand that big difference between this mechanical, illusory arrangement of the material energy as compared to what is available in the spiritual world of that. And by making that comparison, then we understand that we would prefer not to spend hundreds of trillions of years in the material world, but rather to immediately go to the spiritual world. And as described yesterday, I don't know who gave class yesterday.
Sudama.
And it was described there how even the yogis and sannyasis and jnanis, even they somehow manage to attain the perfection and get all the way up to Lord Brahma's planet, still they cannot actually be liberated without becoming a devotee of the Lord, without actually surrendering to Krishna. Even if they attain perfection and get to Brahma Loka, which is the perfection of so many different Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, what have you, Stanga Yoga, they still cannot get liberation. And even Brahma himself, Brahma cannot give them liberation. And even Brahma himself, he cannot actually attain liberation unless he surrenders. He cannot award himself or others liberation. Unless he surrenders to Krishna, he also cannot attain liberation. And therefore, sometimes Brahma, who is not a devotee of the Lord, he has to also come back in the next, at the end of his life. Imagine that, you're a Brahma for the whole, 100 years for him, but hundreds of trillions of years, and then didn't achieve success, and he will have to come back again. So the Srimad Bhagavatam ultimately is explained that it's very, very difficult to enjoy the material world. It's a temporary illusory situation. The real happiness is in the spiritual world, and in order to get there, we shouldn't be pursuing Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, or Astanga Yoga. We should ultimately be pursuing Bhakti Yoga. And even the perfect Karmis, Jnanis, and Astanga Yogis, ultimately, in order to achieve perfection, they have to take to Bhakti Yoga. So they may as well take the Bhakti Yoga straight away. And the best is they can attain, at best, if they attain Brahma Loka, at the end of Brahma's life, some will have to come back into the material existence in the next creation of the material world. Some of the jnanis, at the end of Brahma's life, they may be able to attain impersonal liberation, the jnanis and the yogis, but none of them can actually enter into the spiritual planets of the spiritual sky unless they're actually taken to Bhakti Yoga. So throughout the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, it is teaching It just takes us back to yoga right from the beginning. Avoid hundreds and hundreds and trillions of years of illusory existence and struggle for existence, and go back to Godhead in this lifetime. That's the message of the Bhagavad Gita. So any questions at all on this or anything?
Like you said, the lifetime of Brahma
is
430 trillion years. But for Lord
Brahma, it is actually
100 years. So, to those 100 years, you know, to the past, like this, like we have 100 years. Yeah. And there, you know, it's not a very long time for us. But for the ant, 100 years are huge.
Yes.
So similarly, does Lord Brahma also feel his
100
years going quickly, or?
Yes. The time is, for him it's just 100 years. Yeah, it is relevant.
For us it is.
For example, you know, when King Ravata went to Brahmaloka and he wanted to marry his daughter Ravati to a suitable husband. And when he got there, Lord Brahma was listening to a musical recital. So, you know, it's take an hour or so. And for Lord, just like if we listen to music for an hour, so that for Lord Brahma, that was just an hour or so. But when the musical recital was finished, and then the king approached him, yes, now, you know, I was thinking of, you know, who would be suitable, and Lord Brahma laughed that, you know, not only are all the people you would think you were considering as suitable for marriage for your daughter, not only have they died, but, you know, whole dynasties, you know, have come and gone in the time that we've just been listening to the end of this music, you know. So he said, but if you go right now to the earth planet, Lord Krishna and Balaram have just appeared, and Balaram will be a suitable husband for your daughter, Ravata. So you see that, you know, it's just they pass the time just like we do, but for the other inhabitants of the universe, it is thousands and thousands of years go by in that short time.
Living entity might have been lived for more than one Brahma's lifetime.
That's right, yes, because the living entities, many do, they actually go from one universe to another, and at the end of Brahma's lifetime they remain, you know, in a dormant condition within the body of Mahavishnu. And then when the new universes come out, and the new Brahmas, you know, in those universes, then those living entities come out again. And they may do that many, 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 many times.
So before Brahma, you said that every night of Brahma, the universe is destroyed.
Yeah.
But what is the difference for night of Brahma and the lifetime of Brahma? What happens when I think of both of them? Are they the same?
There are two descriptions. At the end of Brahma's day, it's described in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 8th chapter, a thousand cycle of yugas. So it's four yugas, that's one cycle. A thousand of those cycles is one Brahma's day. At the end of that, Brahma becomes tired. And he takes rest. What happens then is that the universe, the whole universe, is actually destroyed. And everything, all the ingredients for the various bodies and, you know, what have you, and power of the universe, is actually broken down into its elements, and then wound up within the body of Lord Brahma, along with all the living entities. And Lord Brahma actually goes to sleep, and he sleeps within Gavadaksha Vishnu. So then, in the next day of Brahma, therefore, again, there's, from Brahma, all the living entities again take birth, because they've all been wound up with him. We're here, the Radha Muni appears, and, Kumaras, and, Marichi, and different sages, they all appear from the body of Brahma, because they have been withdrawn within the body. They appear from him, from Brahma, literally all the necessary ingredients for the bodies of all living entities appear. So everything is withdrawn within Brahma, and Brahma himself is withdrawn within Gavadaksha Vishnu.
So every universe has, again same for Kumaras, Narada, and
Some of the sons of Brahma live for the entire duration, just like the son for the duration of the father's life. Some of the sons of Brahma therefore live for the entire duration of the universe. But some of their descendants and descendants of lower planetary systems, they're different. They change after every manu. There are 14 manus in one day of Brahma. So there may be 14 different Indras he's described in the 8th canto. See, so some of the different personalities for planetary management, though that may not even last the whole day of Brahma, let alone the whole lifetime of Brahma, and some will last, the whole lifetime of Brahma. Radha Muni, when he appears from Brahma, he appears in his own spiritual body. He doesn't have a material body, so therefore his body is not exactly wound up like some of the other living entities. He may take rest with him, Lord Brahma, but he appears in his own spiritual form again, not a material creation. So there are different varieties of living entities like that. Now, sometimes it's also described that at the end of Brahma's day, there is another type of partial annihilation where not all the planets are destroyed. Everything up to Svargaloka is destroyed, but above that, Brahma's planet and the various living entities there are not destroyed. So there is sort of a partial dissolution as well, where there is a destruction of the universe up to a certain degree. Because sometimes Brahma takes rest also during the day, occasionally, not every day. It's just like when Krishna, the Lord, actually wanted to show Satyavrata, he wanted to display what it was like at the time of dissolution, and he wanted to appear as the Matsya incarnation. So that actually happened during the day of Brahma, so the Lord arranged for Brahma to feel the tide, he took rest, and there was a partial dissolution of the universe up to Svargaloka or something like that, but not the higher planetary system, but enough so that everything was inundated with water, and there was much that appeared. But generally at the end of Brahma's day, the whole universe is actually wound up, and Lord Brahma himself sleeps in yoga nidra within Gavadaksha Vishnu.
So at the time of annihilation, where will the demigods go?
At the time of annihilation?
Yeah.
They reside within Lord Brahma. And then Lord Brahma resides within Garbhadaksha's vision. And then when there is a total annihilation, then all the living entities, including Garbhadaksha Vishnu, withdraw within Mahavishnu. At the end of Brahma's lifetime, you know, generally he's supposed to go back to Godhead. Generally he's, you know, a devotee, and at the end of his life the general course is that he will go back to Godhead, but it doesn't always happen. If, you know, as described previously, sometimes if Brahma a perfect yajna, if there's not a perfect devotee to take the position of Brahma, then a perfect yajna may take that position. And if he remains a perfect yajna and doesn't actually surrender to Krishna in the course of his lifetime, he may be able to attain impersonal liberation. If he's a perfect nishkama karma yogi, then he may come back as a Brahma. Sometimes, the Lord Brahma becomes, you know, particularly independent, they will descend, you know, to lower planets, and gradually, even Brahmas can actually then gradually sink down into various species of life. There is a description that when the living entities first come to the material world, their first position is as Lord Brahma. So from there, they have rivers. I heard much better marketing in class. If each living entity, they come into the material world and they're first, because they're very elevated, you know, from the spiritual world, they haven't really done anything particularly sinful. They take a very elevated birth, usually Lord Brahma. From there, somehow, they manage to descend. So, you can just imagine how many, you know, that gives you an idea. You know, because you consider how many living entities in just one universe. You know, just how long, you know, living entities have been rotating in material existence. That so many, you know, even from a very elevated position of Lord Brahma, have actually managed to descend into lower species of life. It just gives you, you know, some concept of just how long material existence has been going on since time immemorial.
So, I was thinking that even with the material creation, we see that the creation is very well organized or well maintained by the Lord.
Yeah.
Like there is sun, there is plants, there is water, and there is eyes for the living entities.
Everything is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything is there that happens. There's some happiness. There's it's like a drop in the desert. But no, because we're spiritual by nature, of course, then material happiness cannot satisfy a spirit soul. A spirit soul, they're fully conscious, you know, fully blissful, fully, you know, aware, conscious, and they're eternal. And in the material world, someone who is eternal, who has to be repeatedly, you know, kicked out of their situation, you know. So in the material world, we're constantly in a temporary situation. For an eternal spirit soul who relishes, you know, eternal relationships. So generally everyone wants a relationship, you know, you put a lot of work into it, and when a relationship is very sweet, you want that to last forever. But we can never get that. And therefore, it's, you know, how can we be happy? Even if we get some of it, it's just not natural for the spirit soul. The spirit soul wants a relationship, they become very enjoyable, and the last thing you want, yes, we have this wonderful relationship, and then the material energy just smashes it to pieces. Now it's finished, gone. That's not what we want, so therefore we can't be happy. And you know, we're constantly kicked out of our body, we're constantly kicked out of our homes, we're kicked out of our jobs, you know. We're just constantly moved around by the material energy, just like a football. Prabhupada says, you know, if you ever watch football, that's what our position, we're like a football. Someone comes and they grab you and they pick you up and they kick you up the other end of the oval, and you're kicked up there, and there's, you know, 100 people diving, and they kick you over there and they kick you over there. That's what the material energy is doing, just kicking it like a football. But we don't want that. We actually want to be, you know, have our home, you know, somewhere where we call our home forever. And the people that we love and, you know, play with and enjoy their relationship and sing with and dance with, we want to do that with them forever. But the material world just doesn't allow that, any of that. So, and even, you know, the little bit of time that we get with relationships and to be settled somewhere, there is a struggle for existence, and there is so much pain for the body and the mind, which is disturbing, you know, whatever little happiness we manage to find of a temporary nature. So, you know, everything is here, but it is, you know, not the real, say, natural position for the spirit soul to flourish and enjoy eternally. That situation is described in other parts of the Srimad Bhagavatam, so there's a comparison for us to understand. And we look at the material energy, we think, yeah, there's so much facility and what have you, but you really can't enjoy it. And you look at our own spiritual nature, the nature of the spiritual world, and you think, okay, that's where I've got to go. And therefore, and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said, if you want to go there, you know, just chant Hare Krishna. Very simple. Chant Hare Krishna. You know, that's the point. Don't try to become a perfect jnani, kami, or yogi. The best you can get to Brahma life, but you still can't get liberation. Maybe at the end of Brahma's life, if somehow you've taken to bhakti, even on Brahma Loka, then maybe you can go back. But, you know, you can be in the material world for trillions and trillions of years, even as a perfect, you know, siddha, but you still won't be happy. But, you know, one lifetime, chant Hare Krishna, eat prasadam, do a little service, and save yourself trillions and trillions of years of suffering. You know. But sometimes, you know, that's the problem, because as we think, I have to sit down and chant, and, you know, control my mind, and I have to, you know, control my senses, you know, like that. And we think, you know, it's difficult, it's a bitter pill to swallow. Yes, you know, there's certainly some bitterness there, there's certainly some difficulty. You know, we have to control our senses and our mind. There's no doubt, you know, for us, you know, especially someone like me, you know, mind and senses, you know, just uncontrolled, you know, just sort of reeling in and just be a devotee is difficult. But if we swallow that bit of pill, it will save us trillions and trillions of years of, you know, much, much worse suffering. So, you know, therefore we accept, okay. But Lord Chaitanya, you know, even what we consider difficult is because we're conditioned. But when we actually become liberated, when we realize our spiritual nature, then the life as a devotee is nothing bitter about it at all. That's because we're tasting devotional service from a conditioned soul's point of view, but one who realizes, fully realizes their spiritual nature, completely aloof from the body, devotional service is an ocean of nectar. You know, that it just takes a little time, a little maturity as a devotee, and then we achieve that platform. And then the latter body, of course, whether they're in the material existence or in the spiritual world, it doesn't matter. They're actually always absorbed in relishing the actual nature of the spirit soul in its loving relationship with Krishna. It just takes a little bit of austerity to get there. Child worship, Prabhupada.